This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Farewell to the office holiday party. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. First weekend in December. Glad you're with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Fewer companies are hosting holiday parties for workers this year. One big reason, fear of a Harvey Weinstein scandal.
How social media sites like Facebook and Twitter have become the new frontier in fighting violent crime.
Why finding the perfect Christmas tree will be more difficult this year and cost you more.
And the engineer collaborating with the sales staff. The company's pressing for greater collaboration.
Employers really need to respond more quickly to marketplace signals, changes in technology. So they're finding that not only are they handling multiple complex projects at once, but the new variations of the products and services they offer have to be updated more quickly. And it's essential to move fast because the marketplace is changing so fast.
Wall Street Journal writer Sue Schellenbarger on fostering collaboration at work. She's here in about 20 minutes. Facebook and other platforms have emerged as new frontiers in the fight against violent crime that continues to grip major cities. In Chicago, which is on track to have more than 600 murders for the second year in a row, community leaders and police say the immediacy of these platforms has played a major role in escalating disputes. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Shabani Matani. Shabani, what have you looked at?
You know, we've been looking for a while now at different causes of the violence in Chicago and other cities, trying to analyze and kind of go beyond the data a little bit and see what's fueling that. And in my reporting, a lot of people have brought up social media and feuds on social media, and that being a couple of kind of high-profile cases throughout the year, and every now and then it'll sort of crop up. You know, there was a shooting on Facebook Live, or, you know, there was this lady who ran over another lady with her car and killed her over a feud that escalated on Facebook. And so we were digging past, you know, some of those stories and anecdotes, and, you know, law enforcement officials across the board were saying, yeah, I mean, this is a huge driver, and essentially it takes what was already happening sort of in real life or on the streets and puts it on this new medium where things can accelerate much faster and lead to acts of violence back on the streets.
Wow. So is anybody saying that social media is the cause, or social media is just an accelerant and there likely would have been, say, a killing anyway or a violent encounter anyway?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think anybody's saying that it's like the singular sort of cause. I mean, I think it's hard to pinpoint a singular cause for violence accelerating or, getting out of control in some of these cities. It's definitely a multitude of factors. But the law enforcement officials are definitely seeing social media speed things up and make things much more, dangerous much more quickly. So as an example, you might have two rival gangs, and all the gang members are on Facebook. And so if they want to challenge somebody to some kind of fight or they just want to insult the rival gang member, they will say something offensive about them on Facebook and tag them. You know, they want them to see it. They want everybody else to see it. And because of the public nature of this post, right, you know, a lot of people will be commenting on it and sort of even egging them on in some cases.
Wow.
And that could lead to real-life shootings or retaliations.
Oh, my goodness. Can law enforcement be proactive with stuff like this, or is it too hard to track on Facebook?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, they're definitely, individuals within the police department in Chicago and in other cities and prosecutors, too, who can use these open source material, especially after an arrest, right, when somebody's been arrested. Prosecutors can look through all this information and enter some of these posts and photos and so on as evidence in court, which really does help with arrest and sentencing. However, you know, to be proactive beforehand, police say it's extremely complicated because sometimes you don't even know if like a gun is real or not. You don't even know if somebody is joking about beating up someone or shooting someone or whether they're serious about it, right? So you're quite limited in what you can do beforehand.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Midwest reporter Shabani Matani. Her piece is called Social Media Emerges as New Frontier in Fight Against Violent Crime. What are these drill rap videos that you mentioned in the story and how they kind of fuel things?
Yes, I mean, that's like another factor that I found, you know, completely fascinating. So, I mean, I think it's been pretty well documented that Chicago's gang infrastructure, so to speak, is really fragmented. That, you know, it used to be in the 90s that there were a few big gangs and they were very powerful and they had lawyers, you know, they had a lot of territory, they were very, you know, they were business savvy, they could control like big empires. And then the FBI took them all down in stings, and what was left was just tiny, tiny little gangs all fracturing and fragmenting. So what's happened is that some of these gangs, they don't even really have territory. They don't even have that much product to sell. It's not like they have a huge like empire of drugs or whatever. So they turn to social media and specifically drill rap to kind of cement their group's identity, or to say like, okay, we're X group, you know, we have all these guns, we have, you know, this image, and they project that through YouTube and through these drill rap videos. And I think it's pretty, you know, enticing for young men to get involved in this scene, especially, you know, faced with what they see as a lot of hopelessness around them. It sort of lets them project this image that, you know, that they're kind of strong and powerful, even if they don't have that much territory or they don't have a huge strong empire. That has led to a lot of violence. You know, these videos, people post them and specifically insult a rival gang member, or they craft an entire song around insulting a rival gang, and it leads to retaliation, again, because it's so public, and it sort of eggs on the other gang member, saying like, okay, you know, this is what we have, this is what we're throwing out to you, what's your response now?
Thanks, Shabani. Wall Street Journal Midwest correspondent Shabani Matani. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Just looking at the calendar, now that we've hit December, 3 Fridays left before Christmas. That said, the holidays are here, so the endless questions about why you aren't further along in life. You can always count on your family for those, right? Seems they know just how to trigger you and perhaps your low self-worth. How do you manage this? We're joined now by Stephen Grosso, author of Those Who Seek. Stephen, how do you see this?
The holidays could be a tough time for people, especially if they're not happy where they want to be in life, where they don't feel as though they're there. So especially if you're an ambitious person, not feeling like you're living up to your potential can be magnified during the holidays.
All right, so what do you do? I mean, you start facing those questions at the table. You got nowhere to go. You can't kind of squirm your way out of the uncomfortable spotlight. What do you do?
Sure. So fortunately for me, I mean, I have an amazing family, and they're always supportive. But, you know, I can see how that can be an issue for people. So I think the main thing, the most important thing, is to not compare yourself to others. You know, just because someone is somewhere in their life and you want to be there doesn't mean that you won't get there someday. You know, I always like to remind myself of that. Just because you're not where you are in life right now doesn't mean in the future you won't reach your goals. So we have to live our own paths and by our own timelines. You know, so everybody's lives are different. And the holidays can lead to feeling down too, because they're bittersweet. You know, you celebrate with loved ones, but you also think about loved ones that have passed and who you shared memories with. So that can also lead to this low self-esteem during the holidays.
Boy, you can do those comparisons all over the place, right? But you really got to get away from it. You can compare to other family members. Maybe you're comparing to a house that somebody else owns or a car somebody drives, right? That can drive you nuts.
Yes. So, yeah, again, I mean, it goes back to comparing yourself. As you just mentioned, you know, that pressure to keep up with the Joneses, whether it's new car or big house. But I just, you know, everyone has something to deal with in our lives. So we're never alone, even though we feel we are, if we feel we're not living up to our true potential. So I think an important thing is that we live our own dreams and passions. You know, we have to do the things that make us happy. They may not make us rich or popular or whatever, but if they bring us happiness, then that's all that matters. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll eventually reach our goals if we keep going.
Do I understand you went through some depression and that is kind of weaved into the book here a little bit?
Well, let me say, over 16 million people suffer from a bout of depression every year in the United States. So I did go through a bout of depression when I was dealing with unemployment. You know, I felt like I wasn't contributing to society or living up to my potential. And I struggled, and I struggled for a little bit, but I overcame it. And I wanted to include that as a theme in the book, because to show other people that, you know, they can overcome it. I research and I observe life. I do tons of research on depression. I talk to people who actually share their depression struggles with me. So I want to share that human experience and make my characters flawed so that everyday people can relate to that, and that the characters are multidimensional. And I can show that through fiction. So if people are going through depression or they know someone who has, this book they will absolutely be able to relate to.
We're speaking with Stephen Grosso. He's author of a book called Those Who Seek. And we're talking about facing your family during the holidays if you feel maybe you haven't lived up to your potential. Did you have an aha moment, by the way?
An aha moment? I would say, you know, from the research I do on my main character with their internal struggles and also mixed with my experiences, I believe, even though it's cliche, I think that believing in yourself is really the first step to anything. You know, we all have the power within us to change our circumstances. You know, we have to focus on our thoughts. Our thoughts create our lives. I mean, they create a reality. People rarely go from A to Z. We usually go from A to B to C and so on, and realizing that was important in my life. I mean, just taking small steps towards your goal and accomplishing small advancements toward your goal, it makes you feel better, and that was my aha moment. When I wrote my first novel, I gained more confidence with each chapter.
Really?
And now, three novels in, I feel like I can write about anything. Anybody can do that.
It's good stuff. Thanks, Steve. Stephen Grosso, again, the book is called Those Who Seek. It's 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. More companies are asking employees from different departments to collaborate on projects. Easier said than done. For example, how do you get aggressive, fast-talking salespeople to cooperate with reserved, detail-oriented engineers, or intuitive creative types to sync with budget-minded planners? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
What's the best way to improve a relationship? Better communication. As Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal tells us, communication and collaboration are the best ways forward in the workplace. Sue, why are more employers asking employees from different departments to get together and work together?
Employers really need to respond more quickly to marketplace signals, changes in technology. So they're finding that not only are they handling multiple complex projects at once, but the new variations of the products and services they offer have to be updated more quickly. And it's essential to move fast because the marketplace is changing so fast, and so is technology. And that requires people to really work closely together, elbow to elbow, and to get along. So there's a big push for collaboration.
Sue, so what's the incentive for workers to go along with this, especially if they're the type to kind of like to work alone?
This is hard. Individuals often like to work alone. They may like just put their head down and churn out products. What happens at first is that people, you know, get annoyed. They get in each other's way. They really have to work to understand each other's communication styles and work styles. But employees I spoke to who had some experience with this said that they begin to see the benefits in that, first of all, the products they're able to think up and execute are better, broader in scope, and higher in quality because they have all these different kinds of minds working on them. And second, they find unexpected rewards in collaborating. They begin to really appreciate each other's unique talents and contributions. So it is a rugged road, but it can be really rewarding.
Sue, can you give us some specific examples of the type of company where this works well?
It started in software really more than a decade ago, but we're seeing advertising, marketing, education, finance, all kinds of industries are companies in all kinds of industries are moving in this direction, and they're using it mainly in complex projects to build new software, new advertising campaigns, new consumer product iterations, variations on branded products. And so you're seeing it applied really to all kinds of output from products to services.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal about collaboration in the office. Sue, how do you get employees to understand how someone else works? Do you have to bring in someone from the outside, or can you do this inside?
It's really really, it's tough because, you know, a salesperson might talk too fast even for someone else to understand. The engineer may be really quiet and reflective. Creative types don't like working with bean counters. I found that it does take training. The employees I spoke with who really do this well, they've been trained both in work styles. That is, you know, how do you like to work? Do you work best on deadline and fits and starts, slow and steady? And in communication styles, especially in meetings, like, what do you need from other people in meetings? Do you need them to, you know, affirm what you said? Do you need them to help you clarify your thoughts? And this training really helps people smooth out the rough patches that are going to crop up when you work together.
So does the physical layout of an office play into collaboration?
Well, it does. This is complicated. I mean, you can tear down all the cubicle walls, but that can create problems, of course, with noise and interruptions. The companies I spoke with don't have a whole lot of conference rooms, but they do have enough so people can huddle when needed.
If someone just does not want to do this, they just are the kind that sits at their desk and does the best job alone, can managers force them to do this?
Well, companies generally, when they hire these days, make clear what is the work environment like. And most of the time, people must and do bend at least to some extent, although their colleagues can kind of adapt to their work style. In other cases, employers will find an independent contributor spot for somebody who maybe just provides content or data or designs for others to work with. But it's rarer now than it was in the past that this happens.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, the holidays are fast approaching. Order gifts for everyone on your list with a click of a mouse. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how for only $49.99 you can get the family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter my code DEAL in the search bar. That's 75% off. Omaha Steaks offers the most flavorful, tender-aged beef, aged for 21 days to unlock the full flavors of the cuts, hand-trimmed and vacuum-sealed. They also have veggies, desserts, appetizers, fresh seafood, and so much more. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings for our listeners. Listen to everything that you'll get for less than $50. Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus four additional kielbasa sausages free. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code DEAL in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your first December weekend with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, the unspoken problem with digital assistants. Also from sports, are the Eagles making plans for February 4 in Minneapolis? And why the perfect Christmas tree is going to be harder to find this year and more expensive. That story in about 20 minutes. More companies are shunning holiday parties for fear of sexual harassment, but that's not the best answer to fighting the problem. More from Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. Katie, what do we have?
A lot of employers are not going to hold holiday office parties this year. So 11% say they're not going to have a holiday office party this year. That's up from 4% in 2016. It's also the highest number since 2009. And now, this makes sense. In 2009, people weren't holding office Christmas parties because it was a recession and they didn't have money.
Yeah.
This year, they think it's something called the Weinstein effect, right? Employers are really wary of holiday parties because, you know, people are drinking, they're doing stuff. They're really worried that sexual harassment is going to happen at these office parties. So they're just saying, nope, not going to do it. We're not having a holiday party this year. So it's quite interesting. I mean, a big jump, 4% who said no to holiday parties in 2016, 11% saying it this year. And it's really because they're scared of sexual harassment happening at the office party.
Wow. Understandably so, I guess. Well, that's some awareness that's happened, though, right? I mean, folks are just falling like flies, it seems, and not just public figures.
No, that's right. I mean, literally, you see, it seems like there's a new scandal every week now. And so you can't avoid the news. And employers are like, I don't want anything to do with that. I don't want it happening to my company. I'm just going to cancel the office Christmas party. Interestingly, they're also increasingly not going to serve booze at the party. Fewer than half of companies say they'll serve alcohol at their holiday party this year. 62% said it last year, a huge drop in that number as well. And again, that it's what we're calling the Weinstein effect, right? They just don't want people to get a little bit too, you know, had a few too many drinks and something happened at their office party. They don't want that on their watch.
You know, I thought it was fascinating in your story. The group was saying, you know, normally, like, spouses and children aren't allowed. However, that might be one way to actually reduce the incidence of sexual harassment or inappropriate behavior at an office party.
Yeah, the CEO of this of the firm that did this study pointed that out to me. It hadn't really occurred to me, but yeah, creating kind of more of a family environment at a Christmas party versus, like, you know, bro culture, like dudes are just all adults. He said, you know, that's one way. You know, people do take cues from their environment. I mean, will that totally prevent it? Absolutely not. But one way, I mean, and there's a million other ways also that you could absolutely still have a Christmas party, which a lot of people really do enjoy. But you could, you know, point out your policies, punishments on sexual harassment before the party, send reminders, appoint people to be on the lookout for, you know, inappropriate behavior, limit the amount of alcohol. I mean, there's plenty of things that employers could do besides just saying, ah, canceling the party, too freaky, if they do want to, you know, if they want to have this holiday party.
We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. Her piece is called Harvey Weinstein and Charlie Rose Just Killed the Office Christmas Party. New stats indicate 11% fewer companies are actually having a holiday party. Much is blamed on the sexual harassment incidents as of late. You just mentioned, and I was going to ask you, a preventive measure, appointing people to be on the lookout for inappropriate touching, like guys with clipboards walking around and, hey, Jones in accounting. You can't do that. You can't do that.
Look, you got to take it from all ends, but yeah, people in management. I mean, that does happen, right? There's dancing on the dance floor, and there's, you know, somebody with a few too many cocktails grinding a little bit too close to people and making them feel weird. That happens. That often happens in the open. You don't want it happening at your office Christmas party. I mean, they don't have to go around with clipboards. They should just know that they're on the lookout for these kinds of things. I know this sounds like stuff, you know, you just think people, you know not to do it, don't do it. But people are doing it. It's very clear. So, I mean, I think you've got to pull out a lot of stops to make your office Christmas party happen. But, you know, really, the important issue here is that killing the office Christmas party, that's not going to fix this issue, right?
Yeah,
that just
yeah.
takes away one thing, one instance where sexual harassment might happen. You got to do a lot more training. You got to make sure everyone knows you have a no-tolerance policy, all these things, make it easy to report sexual harassment. I mean, companies need to overhaul how they deal with this topic rather than just saying, cancel the office Christmas party, mm-hmm. you know, problem solved. Well, no, this happens all throughout the year, not just at the Christmas party. So I think that's kind of important to point out, too.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you could be with us. Digital assistants driven by artificial intelligence are fast becoming our way to interfacing with everything in our cars, our homes, offices. But the big unspoken problem emerging is that each of these things is largely an entirely separate system with virtually no sharing of common information or consistency of experience. Tech analyst Rob Enderle is here to discuss why that's a problem. Rob, set this up.
We have a lot of digital assistants. We've got digital assistants on our phones like Siri. You've got digital assistants in our home, like, I'm not going to say the name because one of my offices is going to go off. We have digital assistants that are showing up on our cars, and Cisco just announced a digital assistant for the office. These are all really cool. Each one of them learns something, some little thing about us over time, and can aggressively try to address and answer our questions. And as they come to know us, they get more capable and more powerful, and certainly more intelligent. The issue is they're all different digital assistants. So the ones that learn about what you like in the car are not the ones that learn about what you like in your home.
Yeah.
And they're not the ones that learn what you like on the phone or at work. And you're the same person. I mean, it's not like you change. The digital assistant is an interface to you. It isn't really supposed to be an interface back into the machine per se. It's supposed to adopt to how you are. It's a game changer because it goes against a past convention where you had to learn the assistant. And as a result, it's not getting as smart as it should, and that intelligence isn't transferring with you wherever you go.
Mm. So it's there's no adaptation. There's no flexibility, I guess, with these things.
Well, if you think about it, back when we had real living assistants, I mean, some of us had secretaries or admins or whatever. You had that. That was your admin. I mean, when you got in a car, you didn't get another admin. When you went home and you needed some help with something at work, you didn't have another admin. It was that same admin. And the thing is, the digital assistant can literally be with you every place you go, be at your shoulder all the time. But right now, the digital assistants are operating like, you know, graphical user interfaces. They're specific to the application, when they should be specific to you. Instead of having the product, whether it be Echo or your car or whatever, have to learn you individually, it should only have to talk to your digital assistant, and your digital assistant then becomes the expert on you, and that knowledge transfers with you from everything to everything that you use. That's where I think we're going to end up. What we're waiting for right now is a Microsoft kind of company to step in and say, okay, this is the digital assistant standard. This is the framework. Everybody plugs into this, and this digital assistant, which will live virtually in the cloud, will now be assigned to you. And so that now this becomes your digital assistant, and now the longer it spends time with you, the better it learns what you like and don't like. And now when you change cars, or if you decide to go from one device, from one manufacturer in your home to another, your digital assistant figures that out. You don't have to learn a new interface. You don't have to retrain anybody. That's all handled by computer at light speed. So the end result is finally the digital assistant can actually be a true digital assistant and be at your shoulder all the time.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm called The Enderle Group. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Wentz in the shotgun. He's back. He's looking. He fires. And it is complete to Alshon Jeffrey for a touchdown.
Merrill Reese, Philadelphia Eagles Radio Network. The Eagles, 10-1, may be the NFL's most balanced team. But could the Vikings be spoilers for, say, this upcoming Minnesota Super Bowl in February? A couple of subjects addressed by Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay, who, yes, is aware of the dangers of creating a jinx here. Jason, how about them Eagles?
Well, this is the best start they've had since that 2004 team, Gordon, that went all the way to the Super Bowl and lost a close one to New England. The joke is here that Philadelphia, of course, is a tough sports town. We both know this. This is a place that, I don't know if it's a truthful story or not, but the legend has it threw snowballs at Santa Claus many years back. But this is a team that really doesn't have a very clear weakness. They have a terrific young quarterback in Carson Wentz, who is basically, the consensus favorite for MVP at the moment. They have a stellar defense, and they're sort of putting people away early. They really, really beat up on the Bears on Sunday. They're on quite a run lately. And if you look at the rest of the NFC East, they've got that all locked up. So they're kind of doing everything you want to see in a contender at this point. And it's just a little strange because Philly's sort of used to having these crises of confidence about their sports team.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much of a physical risk is it to your health that you might be talking about an Eagles Super Bowl in your column?
You mean in terms of like jinxing it?
Yeah, that and, I don't know, any kind of threats? Like, please be quiet about this?
I think any team that's accustomed to heartbreak is probably a little reluctant to start making Super Bowl reservations. another example of that, Gordon, is Minnesota. The Vikings are 9-2. They are one of the top teams in the NFC as well, playing with a backup to a backup, Case Keenum. This guy, has looked all world all of a sudden, and Minnesota is actually in a strange position to perhaps be coming, Gordon, talk about chasing things, the first team to ever play a Super Bowl on its home field. Minneapolis this year is a Super Bowl host. And wouldn't that be something? No one would have predicted that before the season.
Right. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. His piece is called Philadelphia is Feeling Good About Football, and It's Weird. Change to the AFC, because it just seems like these days you automatically count the Patriots in to, you know, a deep run in the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's just sort of give up on the whole idea of pronouncing the Patriots dead. Remember we did that in September? They went 2-2, and everyone thought, okay, well, maybe it's an off year for New England. But what they've shown really consistently is the ability to sort of restyle their roster, adapt, you know, replace injuries. You know, they are a team that is, if nothing else, quick to react.
Thanks, Jason. It's Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay, who, by the way, is a University of Wisconsin grad. So from the college football scene, he has blocked out this entire weekend and dedicated it to the Wisconsin-Ohio State game. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. It'll be harder to find Christmas trees this year, and the National Christmas Tree Association says that may drive up prices from 5 to 10%. But USA Today says don't blame the Grinch. When the economy started tanking due to the Great Recession in 2008, Christmas tree sales dropped. Growers didn't cut down as many trees as they normally would. As demand fell, that left less room in the groves to plant seedlings. Since a Christmas tree takes about a decade to hit a height of 7 to 8 feet, growers now don't have as many to cut and ship around the country as they have in past years. And supply isn't the only issue. Diesel fuel prices are 46 cents more per gallon than a year ago. That means higher shipping costs for truckloads of trees. Another reason for small harvest today, the decreasing number of growers. The ranks thinned during the recession. A little quick trivia here, by the way. The states that produce the most Christmas trees, Oregon, North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Washington. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.